In principle, we know that it is possible at least to double the food productivity of India, for example, using known techniques which are in everyday use in the agriculturally advanced countries of the world. But in order to do this, it is necessary to apply large quantities of fertilizers to the soil, to engage in elaborate programs of plant selection, to utilize a variety of modern pesticides, and to construct vast irrigation systems. Before one can apply fertilizers, it is necessary to manufacture them. This means that phosphate rock must be mined, sulfuric acid and nitrogen fixation plants must be built, chemical plants must be constructed. This in turn requires that there be steel plants, coal mines, and transportation systems. In other words, food production cannot be greatly increased in a country such as India unless there is in existence a substantial degree of industrialization. But increasing food production requires more than the mere existence of fertilizers and the like. It requires as well that the farmers change their ways of doing things. And as all of us know, it is difficult to change behavior patterns very quickly. This was recognized by William James when he referred to habits as the great flywheel of society. The difficulties which are inherent in increasing food production are illustrated by a program which was well conceived and operated jointly by the Rockefeller Foundation and the Mexican government. As the result of prodigious efforts, the food production of Mexico was increased over a 20-year period at an average rate of about 2% per year. This apparently represents about the maximum that can be achieved within the framework of our existing techniques. And unfortunately, in the case of the Mexican experiment, by the time the 20-year period had passed, the population had grown to the point that the gains were wiped out. The average person had no more food at the end of the program than he had had at the beginning. We are faced then with the prospect that insofar as food production is concerned, we must, like the Red Queen in Alice in Wonderland, run faster and faster in order to stand in the same place. Indeed, there seems to be every likelihood that the people of the world are going to become hungrier before they become better fed. At the same time as industrialization spreads, these hungry areas of the world will gain the power to wage modern war. And as the use of peaceful nuclear power spreads, as it will inevitably do, the capabilities of waging nuclear war will spread as well. Nuclear weapons in the hands of hungry people do not constitute, in my opinion, a cheerful prospect. This situation will almost certainly result in strong desires to take what are believed to be shortcuts. And when these people think of shortcuts, they look to the Soviet Union. China has already adopted communism. Other nations may well follow. And here we must remember that in our modern technological age, the road toward totalitarianism is a one-way street, that no longer is the revolt of the masses possible. That once totalitarian power is gained, it can be maintained in the absence of help or disruption from the outside. The reason for this is that as a result of our science and technology, enormously powerful tools of persuasion and coercion have come into existence and which can be utilized with unprecedented effectiveness by the rulers of nations. And we must keep in mind that these tools will become even more powerful in the future, that we are just beginning to learn how to control men's minds using chemical, biological, and psychological techniques. It seems to me that a part of the tragedy of the present situation lies in the fact that these changes which are confronting us are taking place within the framework of world anarchy. A situation is rapidly developing in the world which will seriously jeopardize both security and individual freedom, and over which, in the long run, we will be able to exert little control. The second part of the tragedy is that our science and our technology, if properly applied, could enable man to create a world in which all individuals have the opportunity of leading free and abundant lives. We know this to be a fact. It is not the lack of technical knowledge or of the Earth's resources which are the major barriers to the evolution of such a world. The primary hindrance is man's apparent inability to devise those human institutions which can enable nations to get along with other nations and man to get along with man, and which can enable us to apply our technical knowledge at the rapid pace which the situation demands. It seems to me that the most important requisite for the survival both of our nation and our freedom is the formulation of long-range goals. The first of these goals involves the recognition that survival and world anarchy are incompatible. That whether we like it or not, we must move toward a rule of world law or perish. We should heed the words of Alexander Hamilton when he asked, "Why was government instituted at all?" And he answered, "Because the passions of men will not conform to the dictates of reason and justice without constraint." I believe that we should declare enforceable world law to be a goal, realizing fully the difficulties which lie in the past. Our second objective should be to do everything possible to make the industrial transition in the presently underdeveloped areas of the world as smooth and as free from turmoil as possible. We should recognize that it is very much in the interest of our long-range security that starvation be eliminated in India, that her population be brought under control, and that these things happen within the framework of a democratic government. In the long run, this is even more important to our security and freedom than the development of the ultimate in intercontinental ballistic missiles. Once we recognize these long-range goals are truly requisites for survival, then it becomes possible to formulate short-range goals and policies reasonably intelligently. I believe that high on the list of immediate objectives should be disarmament and control agreements, such as I've already discussed, under United Nations supervision and control. Equally high on the list should be the establishment, again under United Nations supervision and control, of a program of world development which is truly adequate. I believe that our attempts thus far to aid the underdeveloped nations of the world have been, in the main, a failure. In the first place, we have spent too little. In the second place, that which we have spent has not been spent wisely. In the process, we have succeeded in making more enemies than friends, and I believe that we have injured some countries more than we have helped them. The standard of living of an area which is primarily agrarian in nature can be elevated rapidly only if a multiplicity of problems are attacked simultaneously. In the first place, capital is needed for the creation of production facilities for such materials as steel, aluminum, copper, and chemicals, and for the construction of power plants and transportation systems. Now, normally, this capital would come from savings. But in practically all of the underdeveloped regions of the world, the savings rates are very low, with the result that capital can be accumulated only very slowly. And there is little hope that savings rates can be greatly increased in most of these regions to any really major extent in the near future. It seems to me that the only real hope for a dramatic change in this picture in the years ahead is for those nations which have high productive capacity and high standards of living to devise mechanisms whereby capital can be transferred at a substantial rate to the nations which need it. I believe that it is very much in the interest of the wealthy nations to provide a substantial fraction of the means which would enable the underdeveloped nations to start producing their own raw materials and goods on a scale which is commensurate with their needs. The amount of capital which is needed in these areas is of staggering size. If, for example, we were to think in terms of providing adequate standards of living in the presently underdeveloped areas over a period of about 50 years, I estimate roughly that annual investments of the order of $20 to $25 billion would be required. It seems to me that it is dubious that such expenditures would be possible unless some decrease in arms expenditures could be brought about simultaneously within the framework of controlled disarmament agreements. I believe that the level of investment which is necessary could best be handled through a cooperative organization, preferably within the United Nations. Contributions to this organization could be made by the various member nations in proportion to their ability to pay. Expenditures should not be made in general in proportion to the poverty of a given nation, but rather in proportion to the effectiveness which a given grant would have in expediting development. It seems to me that it would be better for money not to be given at all than for the effect to be negated by such factors as mismanagement, civil strife, or an unseemingly large rate of population growth. Science and technology can contribute enormously to problems of world development in a variety of ways. New techniques can be developed which can decrease capital investment per unit of output. There are numerous technical problems which are peculiar to underdeveloped countries and which could be solved by the concerted application of the techniques of Western technology. Problems which range from the processing of low-grade ores to the development of new methods of birth control to the industrial application of atomic energy. In view of the potential applicability of the tools of Western science and technology to the problems of development, I believe that we should consider establishing, again under the United Nations, a well-endowed research and development institute which would concentrate its efforts in these directions. Such an institute, which could draw upon the technical resources of all nations, could greatly increase the rate of development in the world, and it could enable expenditures to be made judiciously and in such a way that maximum effect could be achieved. At this point, I would like to stress again that the rapid and smooth development of the underdeveloped nations is essential to the preservation and spread of individual freedom in the world. It seems to me clear that if we refrain from accepting this challenge on a scale which is truly commensurate with the need, we do so at our own peril. Returning home, it is obvious that the problems of survival which confront us today are complex, and that those which will confront us tomorrow will be even more difficult to solve. These problems cannot be solved by narrow specialists or by robots, nor can they be solved by persons who live by platitudes and slogans. Indeed, they can only be solved by persons who possess a broad view of the world in which we live, and of man's place within it. In short, by men and women who are truly well-educated, far above the level which is accepted today as perfection. Of all of the problems which now confront our nation, I believe that of education is the most important. The problem of securing some measure of nuclear disarmament is perhaps more urgent, in the sense that if a man's house is on fire, he must put out the fire before he can live in the house. But in the long run, education is the basic requisite for creating the understanding which is necessary if another outbreak of fire is to be prevented.